Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Teacher's Voice, a podcast where I, your host, Aaron Patton, introduce you to teachers from around the Black Hills. In this episode, we talk to Dr. Denise Turner from Black Hill State University. Some of the topics that we discussed are federal standards, children's subversive nature, assessments, diversifying your classroom, and for brand new teachers, how they can approach their classroom. So without any further delay, here's Dr. Denise Turner. How's it going, Dr. Turner?
It is going great, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
So how about you give us a little bit of background information, who you are, where you come from?
Okay, I'm a career educator, which I never actually intended to be growing up. But I started out as a drama teacher in a private school in Northern Virginia, ended up teaching eighth grade speech and drama at a school in Utah Middle School. And then wanted to do my graduate work in English and environmental literature and have ended up teaching people how to be teachers. It's been kind of a circuitous route to teaching.
Pretty lengthy path. So what was the transition from the environmentalist literature to teaching college?
I always wanted to teach college. I thought I was going to teach in an English department, and I thought I was going to teach writing, and I thought I was going to teach literature. But it turned out that the real needs in the world are in education. And we, you know, it's kind of the gift that keeps on giving, right? So, you know, I'm not saying that environmental literature is an important thing for people to know, but something that is more needed is literacy in the world in general, and empowering young learners and as well as learners in higher education.
What made you transition from teaching middle school, right? Teaching
right.
Middle school to moving on up to all the way to college.
Ah, middle school speech and drama. I actually enjoyed that a great deal. I found it exhausting. But I could feel myself getting tired, and one of the things that really started to cut into my love of teaching middle school was the No Child Left Behind stuff and the culture of testing, and I thought that I might be able to do better work to coach people more individually if I had fewer students, and I could do that more effectively at the college level, and it turns out that I have such mixed feelings about this because I still feel like that teaching and learning and especially teaching people to write needs to happen in the middle schools. But I was just so frustrated. So I decided, and I also had an artistic side of myself that was just dying to get out. And I did not have time. I was a working mother. I had two children. And I didn't have time to do any of my own creative stuff. And so I thought, I will just take this 1 year. I'll take a sabbatical. I'll get a master's. And I'll get all of this creativity stuff out of my system. And it turns out it doesn't work that way. So I went back for my doctorate. You know, my kids grew up and I thought, well, you know, why not do something I'm really super interested in, which is to really investigate how people learn and how you teach creative processes.
So give us a little bit of a placement. What years were you teaching in the middle school?
Oh, this is where I get really super old. Like in the 90s. Yeah, just prior to, I think, oh, when did No Child Left Behind start rearing its ugly head? I'm thinking 2002-ish. And by then, I was starting to get comfortable in my own skin as a teacher. I was getting more and more fascinated in how to teach writing well. And it wasn't that these new standards were arriving or that we had to teach to them, you know, certain standards. I mean, I think that everyone should be able to read at a certain level and write, but it just seemed that I just wanted more one-on-one coaching with writers and thinkers, and it seemed like we were just running everybody through a bunch of rubrics.
Just pushing them out as fast as you can, making it more like an industrial.
Yeah, like the rubric was suddenly like how we will solve everything, the fact that you have 200 students, this will solve everything because the rubric, they'll know exactly what they're doing wrong.
So a one-size-fits-all approach then. Is
yeah,
that what
kind
you're...
of. Like if you, like as if you checked, like you need more detail, that would suddenly like explain to them how that happens. And it doesn't.
So did you feel you were losing the ability to teach?
That was, I felt like I was still a great, I felt like I was a good teacher. What frustrated me the most was I couldn't give anybody the kind of feedback that I thought would really empower them as writers and thinkers, because when, you know, you ask for a paragraph and you get 160 of them, even a paragraph is a lot to read and have anything and respond to in any meaningful way. And so that's what bothered me the most. And well, I was trying to do my part of my graduate work while I was teaching, and there was one pathetic year where I didn't turn back their short stories for 6 months. I mean, that's not useful. I think they forgot they did the assignment. So I think, yes, we can accommodate lots of learners, but there is a point in which you're not giving anybody substantive feedback because you can't.
Yeah. So how large was the school?
Oh, we had probably 1,200 middle schoolers, 6th to 8th grade. It was a big school.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it wasn't crazy inner city, but we had our own like version of middle school nuttiness, which weirdly I sort of miss and sort of don't. But I think what I like about middle schoolers and what I miss about them is the subversiveness. Like they're kind of like obeying the rules, but you can see their wheels going around and they're also testing their limits and they're seeing what they can get away with. And I think subversion is not a bad thing to have, because what it does is it's, when someone's being subversive, they're asking why they're asked to do a certain thing. And I kind of think that gets taught out of you. And so, you know, the little punk rocker is going, you know, we're not going to do it. Give it to the man. You know, I kind of had some respect for that.
Did you relate to that?
I absolutely did, because I was in the middle of, I didn't even realize it at the time, but I was in the middle of rebelling myself against my own cultural upbringing. You know, I was a career Mormon at that point. And so the little rebels kind of inspired me. I was like, there's something important that they're doing here that I think is at work in my own life. So that I had a weird affinity for the rebels. Nice question.
So one of your biggest complaints, I guess, has been so far in this interview, kind of the No Child Left Behind and other, possibly other governmental interventions with interfering with the teacher's ability to teach. What do you think that stems from? Do you think that there's better ways to approach how to teach or how to govern teaching, or?
Good question. It's not that there are standards. I'm not one of those people who goes around like waving flags against the Common Core, because actually I think it's a terrific idea to say that here's what we value in literacy, in English language arts. Students should be able to recognize satire. They should be able to recognize propaganda. They should be able to write narratives and arguments. What I think the problem is the assessment of that stuff, because the tests, at least in the schools that I know of that are related to Smarter Balance or whatever, while there's narrative in the core, all that gets tested from cradle to grave or from K to 12 is the argumentative frickin' essay. And that's what bothers me. It's not that there are standards. It's that there's standards that matter, and those are the only ones we measure progress on. And there's got to be something bigger about our lives and our stories than whether or not we can have enough evidence to substantiate a claim. I mean, don't get me wrong, that's important. We should be able to see if something is not substantiated. But I feel like only testing, it's grr. There's got to be something better and bigger.
So the focus is a little too narrow.
Yeah. The standards are great. Fine. Let's write some narratives. Let's do something creative. How about fiction? How about poetry totally got axed because apparently we don't need a side of ourselves that is like deeply feeling, alliterative. I don't know.
So how do you address that with time? Like, how do you feel a teacher's time should be spent or is spent? Do you think it's spent wisely or?
Well, it's as individual as a teacher is. Because I think that this is where this theme of subversion comes back in. I think that it's actually important to say, well, here's the standards. I can't do all of them. But what I can do is say, I value these four or five a lot. And so I'm going to spend some time teaching kids to write well and maybe a variety of genres even, because in our lives, like really, how often once you get out of college, do you write an argumentative essay? So I really think that answer to that is as individualized as the teacher, but it seems to me, at least for English language arts people, that there should be a multi-genre approach, and that goes with what we choose for them to read as well. I mean, I know there's a big focus on nonfiction, which is fascinating, and there's some wonderful stuff out there, but we also like miss out on stories. So I'm thinking variety. I'm thinking a strategic variety that has some relevance in the bigger world.
Gotcha. So let's go back to when you very first started teaching and whenever you first entered the classroom. How did you feel? Did you feel ready for it, charged and poised for the adventure?
I was absolutely unprepared. In every way, especially when I started teaching English. Like when I was teaching drama in Virginia, it was mostly a lot of like, here's your scenes, let's study them. So there was it was less direct instruction, but when I stepped into public school, public ed, middle school English, and nobody had prepared me for this age of learner, which, you know, middle school kids are so nutty because half of the time they seem like little teen, like grade school kids. And then they're suddenly like super sophisticated. So they kind of just like rock this interesting fulcrum of being like children and adults. So I didn't get the age group. And I absolutely had no idea how to put a lesson together. And I didn't know how long things would take. So I'd just be like, I'd run to the teacher next to me and just say, show me everything you say and do. I mean, there's the most shocking thing is that there's just no script. There is no script for this. And so I'd go to my department chair. She'd say, we're going to do a folklore unit. And I remember asking her, like, well, what do you teach in a folklore unit? I have no idea. And her answer, like, quote, was, well, folklore, there's just so much. And it was terrifying. I'm like, okay. I ended up the first year, I finished everything I was supposed to teach, including three novels, a folklore unit, a play, Diary of Anne Frank. I finished everything by March because I was so nervous and I was just running through material. And so it wasn't until March that I had to ask myself, well, now that you've taught everything because you didn't know what to say about that, what matters to you? And that's when I invented a public speaking unit and a debate unit. And I started to think of my job differently. Like if I taught what mattered, what would that look like?
So priorities.
Yeah.
What advice would you give a new teacher that's venturing out into this world of teaching?
Oh, wow. Chance favors the prepared mind. I would say over plan. Like, think about what you love. Think about the change that you want to make. Like, have some crazy altruistic goal that sends you into the classroom. And then really think about what the pieces of that look like. And then once you've kind of decided what that is, then there's that part where you just need to be cozy with making mistakes. I mean, you need to not be afraid to make mistakes. You need to not be afraid of like, well, will I try it? Like, if I try this, will it work? I mean, you have to let stuff fall in its face. Because that's how you know it works.
Trial and error. Trial and error.
Trial and error. Absolutely.
You suggest leaning on a support group like your peers and your coworkers?
Oh, yeah. Hopefully you have wonderful people who you can go to the break room after and say, what just happened? Because, yeah, those connections are invaluable. I still miss my teaching colleagues at that school. I had fantastic people.
That's good. Do you feel that there's any misconceptions or misunderstandings about the teaching profession in general?
That's a really good question, because I think the general populace, you know, that opinions vary widely. But one of the biggest ones I would say is this idea that the teachers don't work all summer. Like, even as a college professor, like, I spend a lot of time thinking about, well, do I want the same textbook? And did this work? And anymore, especially public ed teachers are required to do more and more in service and training during the summer. And so summers end up being this sort of in the public eye, I think, as this long thing in which nobody does anything, when really it's preciously short, and people are working a lot more than I think the public may think they are.
They're not just hibernating, not just, or like, going on vacations on with all their money.
Yeah, baby, rocking the teaching gig.
So life isn't that easy as a teacher.
No.
All right, so going back to your middle school days, or middle school days teaching anyway, what were your best days as a teacher?
Oh, that's a really great question. I think my best days as a teacher were when I was just let my hair down enough to be like, well, authentically who I was and connect with kids. So if I just remember like crazy stuff would happen. Like, I remember trying to pull down the screen once for showing, you know, an overhead of something, and it had caught, and I just kept yanking it and it just like suddenly flew off the wall and into the hall like a shotgun, and I'm like, oh damn. And I think that when students see you just dealing with whatever is happening as a human being, there's this like connection, because they're feeling awkward too. And so, like, I don't know, I think that, you know, my best moments are when, you know, this sounds so cliche, because it's when you're vulnerable enough that they feel like they can take a risk as well. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I remember writing with my students. Like, I would put on the old grinder overhead and give them a writing assignment and let them see that I didn't know what to write yet. And I was thinking, or I'd write a sentence and cross it out. So I think for me, my favorite times were when they saw that this thing, this reading and writing thing, was in a seamless process that we just do flawlessly. It was, and I think one of my biggest successes was a kid who'd been a terrible behavioral problem for everybody else. He'd been in some kind of suspension for 3 months. It showed up in my class, and I'm like, we're going to write together. And he would not write. He'd open his notebook and for 2 weeks would not write anything. And I would try to coach him on the side, and my heart was bleeding for him, because I could see that he was frustrated too. And finally, when he broke out, like when he finally put pen to paper, he was like this amazing poet. Like, it was crazy the stuff he started to write. So I think that he just needed some patience and see that this whole thing is messy. And for me to not go, well, if you don't write 10 things, I'm going to fail you or send you back to suspension or whatever. So I don't know. That's a long way around not giving you an answer. But yeah, my favorite times were when people, kids, me included, sort of busted out of our comfort zones and said, well, here's what learning looks like. It's really messy.
So now how about the opposite of that? Some of your worst moments or harshest days teaching?
Oh, my harshest days were when I felt like it's still my bad dream in August that I still have, where they've shown up and I've shown up and I don't feel like what I have for them that day is worthy of their effort. And when I realize like mid-lesson that it's not working, or I'm realizing mid-lesson that whatever this story I've chosen is not worthy of their effort, and they're grinding along and being good sports. And honestly, I believe a lot of our discipline problems in schools have to do with are not picking stuff that's worthy of their effort, that's relevant to their lives. And so my worst days are when I felt like I was giving them challenges that weren't either challenging enough or relevant, and I could just see that they didn't give a shit. And I'm not sure that they should have. Those were the worst days, when I felt like I was falling short, when I felt like what I had given them was meaningless, but that was my own fault.
So how do you deal with that? Like your mid-lesson or mid-lesson plan, and you get to a point where you're like, oh shit, this isn't working. This is not worth their time. What do you do?
Oh my gosh. You just, oh geez, that's such a good question. Sometimes you just let it go to shit.
So like I remember once, crash.
Okay, here's an example of that. Like, so when I was new at the job, I hadn't really connected to the fact that you have students read something for a reason that is also tied to thinking and writing. So I asked them to read Mark Twain's Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, right? Because it's like about long enough to take the class period, but not quite. And we could like talk about tall tales and, hey, folklore. So I'm tying it in, but I don't know how to extend it with a writing prompt or make it relevant to them. Like, why should they give a shit? So because I don't know how to extend this into their lives or into an authentic writing prompt, what I had them do was make origami frogs and jump them around the room, which I created my own hell that day. Because eighth graders want nothing better than to make origami frogs and jump them around the room. Now, if I had a thought, I would be like, you know, do you exaggerate the truth in your own lives? What if you have this frog and you were going to make a crazy story about it? What if I hooked this activity to something in like literacy and in writing? But I didn't. I was just like, oh, well, we're done reading, so what we'll do is make frogs. So, you know, trials of the uninitiated.
Yep. How would you define the teaching profession, or how would you define teacher?
Would I define teaching just sort of in general? Mm-hmm. Ooh. That's like so embarrassing that I'm not sure. I'd like to put it in like super altruistic terms, I guess, that somehow you instill a sense of curiosity, like, or a sense of like, oh, there's something that I think I could learn, I could improve. I guess I like to think of teaching and learning as sort of this reciprocal thing in which you meet people where they are and kind of like give them more questions than answers in certain ways. I mean, I guess ultimately I really would like to see teaching as something that inspires people to want to learn more all the time. Like, not just to like, oh, well, I passed my end of level tests. maybe teaching is showing the relevance of information in the world.
Well, I think that's a wrap.
Well, thank you. This is fun.
Thank you for being my guinea pig and being my very first interview. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to the very first episode of Teacher's Voice. If you have any comments, questions, either for me or that you would like me to ask the teachers that I interview, leave them below and I will get back with you as soon as possible. So long for now.